Good afternoon. Welcome to the Business Transportation and Economic Development Committee. We're going to go a little bit out of order today. Open a work session on Senate Bill 704 first, and Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 704 exempts persons performing work for the purpose of agricultural drainage, agricultural trenching, or agricultural irrigation from licensure as a construction contractor. It exempts persons performing work on forest lands for which notice of operation has been filed from licensure as a construction contractor. We have no revenue impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal on this measure, and I've received two amendments, which I've handed out, dash one and a dash two.
Thank you. As courtesy, Representative Benz, would you like to address the amendment to the bill before we hear the bill? And let you get back to work.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and Senators. Cliff Benz, District 60, House District 60, which of course is Malheur County, Harney County, Baker County, and part of Grant County. We have lots of trenching and lots of fences in my district. We have 27,000 square miles and very few consumers, lots of businessmen and women. And I note in looking at the Construction Contractors Board website that the purpose of the license is to ensure the protection of consumers' rights. And of course, the ranches and farms and businesses scattered across my district, for the most part, are much more interested in calling whoever they know that builds fences, digs ditches, and get the job done. I received a telephone call from one of my constituents who is a fence contractor. He'd worked on the same ranch for 3 years. He built about 100 miles of fence and wondered why he needed to be licensed. And I told him I would check into it. I spoke with the Construction Contractors Board, Craig Smith, administrator. He told me about Senate Bill 704. He thought that agricultural fences fit nicely with agricultural trenching, and so I suggested this amendment, the dash two amendment, in fact. So I support the bill, I support the amendment, and hope that the committee sees fit to pass the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much. Well, let's get back to work. For the record, I believe I misspoke and opened a work session rather than a public hearing, so my intent is we'll actually do both. We'll also open a public hearing on this. So we are in both now, so take care of the amendments. And now, who do we have here? Who's the... and Sandy Flicker for representative to sponsor the bill.
What happens when I sit next to you?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I'm staff for Senator Alan Olson. With me today is Matt Olson, who is also staff for Senator Olson. And the senator is a sponsor of this bill, and he is currently in another committee hearing, so he asked us to come down and make a statement for the record on his behalf. So I will do that. Senator Olson is a new senator representing Senate District 20. He's been a licensed general contractor for about 32 years in Oregon, and he serves on the Natural Resources Committee. And he wishes to testify on this bill in support of the Senate Bill 704. 704 is brought forth today to exempt a person or persons performing work for purposes of agricultural drainage, agricultural trenching, or agricultural irrigation from licensure as a construction contractor. It also exempts persons performing work on forest lands for which notice of operation has been filed from licensure as a construction contractor. I just made Richard's speech for him. From the Construction Contractors Board website, we see that the board was created in 1971 as the Builders Board and is responsible for safeguarding the security and property of the citizens of Oregon by preventing and resolving construction contracting problems and by ensuring contractors' compliance with the law. The board administers the Oregon Contractors Law that provides for licensing of residential and commercial contractors, subcontractors, home inspectors, investigation and adjudication of complaints filed against licensees, and assessment of sanctions against unlawful contractors. The board tests applicants on a 16-hour course in construction laws and business practices. The board also engages in education activities aimed at preventing construction problems, resolving disputes, and promoting a competitive business environment. Oregon law requires anyone who works for compensation in any construction activity involving improvements to real property to be licensed with the Oregon Construction Board. This includes roofing, siding, and several other activities. Senate Bill 704, Section 1, lists 18 exemptions from the requirement to be licensed. As you can see from the statement of the Construction Contractors Board, the focus of licensing and continuing education is on residential and commercial construction. Those contractors who install agricultural drainage, irrigation, or trenching, or those that work in forest lands, fall outside the scope of the Contractors Construction Board and its mission as stated previously. Chair Beyer and committee members, I ask for your support of Senate Bill 704.
May I ask, is the Dash 1 amendments yours?
Mr. Chair, no.
They're not?
No, they are not. Yeah. But I understand there are amendments to the bill that you'll be hearing shortly.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Rapp.
The Dash 2 amendments, which I just walked in on, I think we, if you look in the bill, that it kind of deletes part of the bill that we don't want to delete. So I agree with adding agricultural fences, but it calls for the deletion of the substitution of page 3 and delete line 4. Oh, hold on. Have you got that figured out?
No.
Chair, okay.
What's your point?
Well, the question I have is her opinion on the Dash 2 amendments.
No, it just adds
delete line 4.
Delete line 4. It's just adding construction of agricultural fences. Okay, sorry. It should be okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, that was our understanding, that it didn't do anything but add.
Okay.
Add to the existing bill.
Looks like a good bill.
Okay. Any others? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, let's see. We have three other people here. Roger Beyer, Ron Hostler. Did I say that right? And Jim Geisinger. You want to come up as well? You want to start, Roger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Hostetler Farm Tiling and Oregon Small Woodlands Association, both in support of this bill. And just for the record, the Dash 1 amendments were drafted at my request, they simply add an emergency clause to the bill as drafted. I'd basically just like to offer my support on behalf of Oregon Small Woodlands Association, private landowners. We feel we have the right, we should have the right to hire the people we want to work in our forests. And whether they are licensed or not, if we want to have licensed contractors, we support the right to have licensed contractors available, but we don't think it's a state business to say we have to use licensed contractors. I'd like to introduce Mr. Ron Hostetler. His testimony should be handed out to you now or shortly if you don't have it, and I'll let him talk about the agricultural drainage piece and trenching, and we'd be then happy to answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chairman, members.
For the record, sir, could you put your name on record?
Ron Hostetler. Essentially, I guess where it comes to play, I'm a third generation doing exactly what I do today, approaching 70 and continuing to work. So have I been approached in the past by the CCB? And the answer is no. We have worked in construction only as far as agriculture is concerned. Have done in the past projects for schools, just on a call basis, community. We don't go out and actively search anything that's going to come into play. In the past, we have done projects under public oversee and have laid it out that we don't have a CCB license and let them search it out, and they've come back to me and said, you don't need one. I have never had anything in writing. Now, I've been doing this myself 35 years actively, but I traveled with my father, and like I say, I'm a third generation. We're confused because when I look at the books and the stuff, the materials furnished by the CCB, probably a good third of that has to do with building. And in essence, talks about building in terms of appendages or amendments to structures. We are clearly in a field. I am governed by OSHA. We carry all of the insurance requirements that are required. And like you see in the statement that's been prepared, if we were to work for somebody, and I have probably five competitors that maybe make a living doing what I'm doing in the state of Oregon, we wouldn't be in business. And we're pretty much all family businesses. I can't explain it any differently other than that we don't really have a problem. If we get a problem, as the CCB states it, pretty much they are there for the both sides, actually, but basically for the consumer. We don't have complaints. If we have something go wrong, we're there, we fix it. I'm working for probably the third generation that we've worked for, and we go back for repeat business on a constant basis. So all we're asking is that we're able to take care of the situation we have. We don't really fit the rigors and the statements that are put out by the CCB.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Questions?
None. Chairman Boyer, members of the committee, my name is Jim Geisinger. I'm the Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers. Our association represents contract logging companies and firms associated with the logging industry, and we have for the past 41 years. Most of our members are also small family-owned businesses averaging around 10 employees apiece. We do have some members that have over 100, but you could count them on one hand. I'm here today to express our support for SB 704 and to encourage you to send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. What it would do for us is clarify that companies performing logging and associated forest management activities on private lands, which are subject to the Oregon Forest Practices Act, probably one of the most environmentally stringent forest management protection laws in the land, to be exempt from licensure under Construction Contractors Board rules. This exemption would be very helpful and timely in improving the bottom line for our members and more accurately reflect the nature of forest management operations, including the harvesting and transportation of timber and the construction of logging roads necessary to perform those operations. We strongly believe the practice of forestry on private land should not be subject to the CCB licensing requirements. I find it very interesting that the federal lands have been exempted from this licensing for a long, long time for the same activities that we conduct on private lands. Nearly 60% of the forest land in Oregon is owned by the federal government, and a general contractor's license is not necessary to work on these lands. So we believe passage of SB 704 would level the playing field for all of our members, treat all ownerships and activities in a fair and consistent manner, and allow the contractors who perform the work to function in a more efficient and flexible manner in these very difficult economic times. I appreciate the chance to testify, and I would ask for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Senator Trump. This would be for Mr. Boyer. Have you seen the Dash 2s? And I'm kind of surprised. I'm sorry because I missed some of the conversation, but agricultural fences, do you feel like that? It seems to me like it would be advantageous to the bill, but do you have an opinion on that?
Chair Boyer, Senator Girard, I have seen the Dash 2s. In fact, I just picked them up in the back of the room, and when you said the delete part of the important part, I figured I'd better go find out what they do.
Yeah, no, that's...
I believe the Dash 2s are fine. I believe they fit into the same general thought of the bill, which is working agricultural ground does not really fit in or logging does not fit into the scope of the Construction Contractor Board, so I would encourage adoption of the both amendments. The reason for the emergency clause, and I very briefly go back to my past life when I used to complain about too many emergency clauses being stuck on bills that weren't truly emergencies, and
I'm glad you remembered.
I I plead guilty to that charge that I just made of myself, but at the same time, in this case, I believe it is an emergency, because if this bill is to pass without an emergency clause, it would not go into effect until January 1st of next year. The busy time for both loggers and egg trenching is in the dry months of the summer, so that would force them to be in limbo then for an entire work year as to whether or not, you know, a bill has passed but has not yet taken effect, and do I need to go work on a construction contractor's license or not? So in this case, I believe there is truly an emergency, and it warrants the emergency clause, Mr. Chair.
Good pitch. Is there any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we do not have a fiscal, but we are in work session, and the chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 704. Is there any objection? Should ask, is there any discussion on that? Is there any objection? There is none. They are adopted. The chair would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 704. Is there any discussion on those? Is there any objection? They are adopted. We will close the work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 704. Waiting for fiscal. Let's see, now we want to go to back to the top.
Yep.
Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 384.
Senate Bill 384 revises the billing cycle in construction contracts from 30 days to monthly. It changes the statement requirement for alternative billing cycles. It allows the specification of alternative time limits for final payment. And it allows the prevailing party in disputes over interest to collect reasonable attorney fees. There's no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal on this measure.
Thank you. Jeremy Milley? Did I get close?
Pretty close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's Jeremy Vermilia, Lake Oswego, Oregon. I am an attorney in Portland, and I am here on behalf of the construction law section of the Oregon State Bar, our executive committee, of which I am a member. The construction law section of the bar proposed SB 384 in order to make several minor amendments to the Oregon Prompt Payment Act, the Private Prompt Payment Act, so that it can be basically a little more clear and a little more user-friendly for contractors in Oregon. The Act, or the OPPPA, provides controlling payment terms for private construction contracts. Our review of the statute revealed several internal inconsistencies and ambiguities that make it hard to implement or follow in practice, even for the practitioners who practice in this area of law, such as myself. And so we tried to correct that. And so the principal issues addressed, there's essentially four primary areas that are addressed in this legislation. I'll go through them one at a time. And this is in addition to just making some grammatical corrections. The first is essentially an effort to conform the statute to industry practice and common usage. The payment cycles that are listed in the statute are 30-day payment cycles. Well, as we all know, there are only 5 months in the year that are 30 days, and what we'd like to do is change the term 30 days to monthly so that when you invoice, you're invoicing on a monthly basis as opposed to a 30-day basis, and this would make that clear throughout the statute. The second is to clear up some inconsistencies in the statute. There's inconsistent language that's used for the same or similar circumstances throughout the statute, such as inconsistent use of the word alternate as opposed to alternative, or contract for construction contract, which is also a defined term in the statute, and various iterations of plans, specifications, and addenda, etc. So these inconsistencies then create ambiguity within the statute that can be avoided by these simple amendments to consistent use throughout the statute. The third primary area is to clarify when interest is going to apply. The OPPA permits recovery of attorney fees to clarify when attorney fees apply. Attorney fees are recoverable on disputes where the interest penalty provision comes into play. And it appears that the intent was that the attorney fees would only be applicable where you're trying to recovery interest under that late payment penalty provision. But under the language of the statute, you could potentially interpret this language in different ways. Our goal was to try to make it more consistent with what the Public Works Prompt Pay Act states, which is that attorney fees are only recoverable on a statutory basis when you're seeking recovery under the penalty interest clause. And so our amendments here make that more clear, that that is the only time you're entitled to statutory attorney fees. And then finally, we notice that there are opt-out provisions in three of the four prompt payment deadlines, depending on how you structure your contracts. But there is no apparent reason why the fourth deadline, which is the time for final payment, does not also have an opt-out provision. This would essentially correct that omission and make the fourth part consistent with the remainder of the deadlines in the statute. We think that with all of these changes, the OPPPA will function better for private construction contractors and for their clients. The only other note I would make is that in reviewing the current version of the bill, we noticed a number of typographical errors that should be corrected, and we'll be submitting a proposed amendment to make those corrections as well. And in my written testimony, you'll see a list of specifically what those are. With that, I have no further testimony unless anyone has any questions.
Senator Girard.
Well, I actually tried reading this thing, and I appreciate lawyers. Page 7, line 7. Okay, it says, in any action, claim, or arbitration brought pursuant to this section, the prevailing party shall be awarded, now what it used to say, reasonable costs and attorney fees. Now you took the reasonable out of costs, but you kept the reasonable with attorney fees, and my question would be, why do we remove the reasonable from costs? Because that seems like some, you know, a place where you could pad a bill or something like that.
Normally, thank you, Senator Girard. Mr. Chairman, normally the way it works is courts award actual costs. In other words, you bring in costs when in litigation are determined by the Oregon rules. And there's a limited category of costs, things like court reporter costs, the cost of recording a document at a recorder's office, things of that nature, filing fees. So you have to demonstrate that you've actually paid the cost, and then you're entitled to recover actual costs. So the term reasonable doesn't really have the same applicability with respect to costs as it does with respect to attorney fees, which are subject to different rates, et cetera, communities, things of that nature.
Good answer. Okay.
That work,
yeah. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rick Thomas.
Holmes.
Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer, members of the committee. Rick Thomas, representing Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Both the organizations were very involved in the actual creation of the prompt pay statute back, I believe it was a 2003 session. Worked real hard to get that passed at that time. I think most of the changes here, in our view, are mostly technical in nature. We do not have any opposition to the bill, mostly just moving things around in statute, like Mr. Valera said, to kind of clean things up and get them consistent with other areas of statute.
Questions?
Do you have any comments?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Do you have any comments with regards to what Senator Girard asked?
Senator Beyer, Senator Atkinson, members of the committee. Not really. I mean, I think I would defer to the legal minds on exactly how that process works.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. That's all the people who have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? There is none.
So we did spell check issue on this?
Spell check issue?
We're going to get a new draft?
We're going to get, I would ask that you work with committee administrator to get the amendments we need. We've got a little time since we don't have a fiscal impact statement. I suspect that won't take too long. So we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 384 and await for amendments. And that brings us up to, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 674.
I used to do that.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 674 eliminates the requirement that the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services examine rating organizations at least once every 5 years. There's no revenue on this, but we don't yet have a fiscal on it.
All right.
No revenue. Who's that? No fiscal.
I don't have a list yet.
And no impact.
I got a sense that this is Mr. Cross.
Paul, how are you?
Fine, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I saw you wave, so I feel free to come forward. Thank you very much. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Surety and Fidelity Association of America in support of Senate Bill 674, and appreciate that the committee was willing to introduce this as a committee bill to solve this issue. First of all, briefly, the Surety and Fidelity Association has been around for a long time. It was formed in 1908, and it is the kind of organization that exists and is licensed in nearly every state. The only state it's not licensed is in Texas, which handles these issues in a separate, special Texas way. But these are associations that actually gather statistical data about claims and risks in various lines of insurance, and of course in this case it's for surety insurance, contractors bonds and those kinds of things, and fidelity bonds, and provides that to licensed insurance companies, and they use that statistical data to determine their rates. Oregon has passed a model act a number of years ago, and it provided that these organizations should be examined periodically, which we agree with, but the old model act required that the examinations occur every 5 years. The newer model act, and most states are moving to the newer model act, say that the examinations by the state should happen as often as the director of the department with that responsibility deems expedient. So all this bill does is remove the requirement that an examination be done every 5 years. It allows the director to do so whenever the director decides it's important to do so. It also, as in current law, allows the director of our department to accept an examination done by some other state if that director feels that examination was appropriate. Before the bill was introduced, my client spoke with Teresa Miller, Administrator of the Insurance Division, and talked to her about this issue, and I confirmed as we were introducing the bill that the Insurance Division here has no objection to the bill, recognizes this brings Oregon law up to date with the new Model Act, and I don't know of any other opposition. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Cosgrove?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cosgrove. So at the, as often as the director deems expedient, do you anticipate that being more than 5 years?
Or less? Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, within a small association that has what we call monolines, just one type of insurance, likely it would be less often than every 5 years. Frankly, with other kinds of rating organizations that deal with multiple lines of insurance, the examinations are more frequent. So for my client, it is likely to be less often than every 5 years.
Mr. Chair, a comment. Years ago, I had a very interesting conversation with former Governor Kulongowski about this issue, about when he was insurance commissioner. And while Oregon had a very small market of insurance, whether it be LifeWise or whoever, the authority saying that the insurance department had a concern with something sent shockwaves to other states with much bigger markets, in which it got insurance companies, got their attention with regard to perhaps some actions that they didn't want before the legislature, and gave the insurance commissioner the ability to, for lack of better words, have leverage. Oregon is on its own has little leverage, but if you combine Oregon with the threat of a complaint, so to speak, to Arizona or Washington, it had tremendous leverage. And I'm worried that we're going to give that away in this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, I don't...
I guess that's a question. Sorry.
I assumed it was. Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I don't think that's an issue, a result of this bill for this reason. First of all, the latitude that the Insurance Division Administrator, or actually the Department of Consumer and Business Services Director, is technically our Insurance Commissioner, but those two people working in tandem, they have the same amount of latitude. They could require examinations at any time. So it doesn't require them to do it less often than they are doing it now. It just permits them if they think everything is fine. So I think they still maintain the leverage that if they want to do an examination and raise an issue, and I agree with you, any state that raises an issue for most of these organizations, that's a major problem, whether it's a small state or a big state, because they pride themselves on being licensed in all states and being able to perform the services in all states. So it doesn't take away the leverage. It just means that it doesn't have to be exercised when there's no reason to exercise it unnecessarily. The costs of the examination fall back on the association. That's why our interest is in having it only done when somebody thinks it's necessary.
It strikes me, Senator, that your concern is as often as the director deems expedient actually gives, doesn't give any more strength because that was there before, but it doesn't
just
weaken
it. Just an interesting point, because the problem is that most of these things are complaint-driven anyway. And so, you know, a problem isn't going to get essentially to the insurance commissioner until it's a big problem. Until, you know, a state senator or a rep or somebody has a constituent who has an issue who raises that concern. And I want to make sure that that consumer has as much protection as possible. That's and I think you're right. Thank you for answering it. But to me, that's just, I'm a little sensitive to that issue.
Good observation. Other questions?
That's all I have.
Thank you.
To testify, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Hearing none, we will then close on Senate Bill 674 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 785. Senator Telfer.
You can give us a little boost.
I'll do my best. Oh. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, I am Chris Telfer, the senator from sunny Central Oregon, also known as District 27. And I want to thank you all for hearing this bill. There's a need to truly protect the private sector jobs, and holding this public hearing is going to be helpful to that. In 2010, when unemployment in Oregon was outpacing most of the rest of the country, the legislature passed House Bill 3698. The bill created the BOOST program, which is Building Opportunities for Oregon Small Business Today. Nice short title. To enhance economic development and create private sector jobs. Unfortunately, though, the implementation of this program and other programs of the Oregon Business Development Fund have, in fact, cost private sector jobs and opportunities. In particular, applicants for BOOST loans and grants must use the state staffing services and are not allowed to use those with private industry. In other programs such as the Enterprise Zones, the state is offering staffing services at no charge, thus undercutting service fees of staffing agencies. You know, when the state does it, there is no overhead. Taxpayer dollars are paying for those. You know, there's a saying that says if you can find the service or the activity in the yellow pages, the state maybe should not be doing it. While the BOOST program sunsets June 30th, 2013, this bill is needed for the remaining time of BOOST and other programs within the Oregon Business Development Fund. We will be fine-tuning this a little bit so that you will be looking at some amendments. We are working with the Oregon Business Development Fund and John Saris in trying to make it right for Oregon private industry when in their attempt to create jobs. I bring this bill to you from concerns of constituents of mine, one of which has braved the snowstorm in the mountains and has joined me today at the panel here. Happy to answer any questions. I don't know if you want to continue with a conversation from my constituent first, though. He'll go into more specifics.
And why don't we do that, Mr. Lambert?
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. We have a staffing company, Mid-Oregon Personnel, in Central Oregon. We have offices in Bend, Redmond, Madras, and Pineville.
Sir, could you put your name on the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Gregory J. Lambert, President, Mid-Oregon Personnel Services, Pineville, Oregon.
Thank you.
As I said, we have Mid-Oregon Personnel with four offices in Central Oregon and in three counties. The unemployment rate for the last 3 years, when you consider self-employed and other people who don't necessarily count on the unemployment rolls, we've been in excess of 20% for 3 years. To operate a staffing company in that kind of an environment has been a challenge. We've been successful, but these kinds of additional challenges are not real welcome. Our core client in Redmond was approached three times last year, once in the spring, once in the summer, once in the fall. And the basic conversation was, if you'll quit using Mid-Oregon Personnel, we'll pay you $2,500 for every person you hire through the Boost program. And part of the information I gave you on, I think it's the third page of where it talks about the Boost, it says employees are not persons hired through a temporary agency. And the verbiage above that includes worker leasing companies. And so as the Boost program was specifically targeted to companies with 100 or fewer employees, that is a large segment of our market when it comes to worker leasing and staffing. And the first time our client was approached, they said no. They understood, they realized that their turnover rate for 90-day employees had been in excess of 50% before they started using us. We're not a day labor company. We're not just shipping people out. We're trying to find a good match of an applicant and a company. Their turnover rate for the first 90 days dropped to less than 10% after starting using our services. And when they saw that and the money that saved them, the $2,500 that they might receive if the employee actually worked 35 hours for 26 consecutive weeks and didn't quit on week 25, that $2,500 didn't add up to cover the cost of the increased turnover. But to go to a company and say, you must change your hiring practices, you must sever your relationship with these private personnel services, and we will pay you to do that. That's what was said. I don't know the exact words. I wasn't there. But I talked to the people who were responsible for it, and they said, yeah, that's how we did it. And that was one example, and I know there's been more than one. The enterprise zone situation is another similar situation. In order to qualify for enterprise zone tax treatment, you have to sign a first source hiring agreement with the Employment Division. The implication is very clear, and it says in there, you must give preference to the candidates supplied by the Employment Division. In fact, when Scott Reynolds of Employment Source in Bend, Connie Worrell Drewliner from Express Personnel Services in Central Oregon, one of the larger firms, and two of my managers and myself met with the regional manager. We talked about it, and she said, what's the solution? And I said, write a letter, explain that if you're in an enterprise zone, you can use a staffing company. So she wrote a letter, and in part it says, and you have on your first page your information. The answer is yes, you can. Next paragraph. But candidates referred by the WorkSource Oregon Employment Division must be given priority consideration. Next paragraph. It's important to note that a temporary employee, and she's referring to somebody from a staffing company, does not accrue toward the company, the enterprise zone company's committed employment goal until that employee has been hired into permanent status. That's contrary to the law. The law specifically says that they can work with a staffing company. And the criteria is not temporary in that it's a temporary employee from a staffing company, but the job itself can't be temporary. It must be 32 hours a week or more than 32 hours a week for at least a year with no expected end date. That's the criteria. But this is the way it's been presented by the Employment Division for years, and we've had to battle with that. And so I guess my request is that the Employment Division work as a team with all employers, as the law does require, and treat staffing companies as employers, because we are. We're working hard to find good jobs for people who need work. And I don't think that's something that's detrimental to anybody in the state. We pay taxes, and we support the Employment Division. They provide some very important functions. We use them. We have a good relationship with them in many ways.
But these are two examples of where it's really been an added challenge for us, especially for these last few years when it's been such a struggle.
Questions of the senator? Or
yes.
Senator
Atkinson. A couple of quick questions. Do you know how, if your experience has been shared by others in other parts of the state? Other staffing companies?
Chairman Beyer and Senator Atkinson. I'm aware of the Central Oregon issue. I have worked in the past with on some similar issues with Cardinal Services out of Coos Bay, North Bend. They have an office in Central Oregon. And one of the things we worked with there was, in the past, the Builders Board required us to be licensed contractors in order to provide staffing services to licensed contractors. I was able to go to the Builders Board and say, you know, you really don't want me building your house. You don't want me building your doghouse. I can't make it square. There's no reason for me to be a licensed contractor to provide staffing services to other licensed contractors. And so, and Cardinal worked with us, and they took the lead here, and that was effectively changed. So these kind of things are affecting everyone in the state.
But if I went to, one other question, if I went to Express, a Zinnium, a Higher Calling, other staffing companies, would they share your, do you know if they would share your this concern?
Chairman Beyer, Senator Atkinson, I believe they would. When we met with Laurel Werhane, the regional manager of the Employment Division of Bend, Employment Source, Scott Reynolds, Econo World, Drew Reiner, and Express, they were there along with us, and they were expressing the same concern. So I would assume it's the same throughout the state.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's all I have signed up for this. Does anybody else wish to comment? Is the Employment Department here? Economic Development Department? Y'all come on down.
Strikes me as there are two major issues here. And I frankly was not here when they passed the Booth program, so I don't know. One is the requirement of where the referrals have to come from, whether they can come from private employment agencies or they have to come from the state employment office. That's one. And the second one is the issue of who's an employee. Can you use employee leasing firms? So can you clarify that for us?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. To answer your question, there's actually, as you mentioned, two separate issues. The first is that when it comes to the actual recruitment of these new hires, the agency does not provide any direct assistance with the recruitment or the...
So clarify who the agency is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oregon Business Development Department does not provide any direct support to the company for the recruitment of employees and the hiring of those. The other issue that we have is that once one of the conditions of the Boost Grant Award is that the employee must have been out of work for 60 or more days immediately prior to their hire. The issue that happens in working through an agency such as the one that we just, a company such as Mid-Oregon Personnel, is that once they're hired at the personnel company, they're no longer considered out of work. And the personnel company doesn't meet the trade sector requirements of the Boost Grant program as well. So there's two qualifying issues there that occur when the staff are hired through a staffing agency.
Okay, you lost me on that last one a little bit. In terms of when you say that when they're hired, is that the employee... leasing question?
When the employee...
Separate okay. Issues here. If you said the person, the applicant, has to be out of work 60 days, it strikes me that a private employment agency could do that work, whether they want to or not, I don't know, but could do that work and provide the employer, the business loan applicant, with applicants who meet that 60-day unemployed qualification period of time. I guess there's a question of who would certify that, and I don't know what your requirements is there. That's one issue. The other one, again, is the employee leasing. What I thought you were saying is at the point when Mr. Lambert's agency employs as a leasing company that person who may have been unemployed for 60 days or longer, they then are no longer qualified because they were employed by the leasing company. Is that what you're saying? I guess there are two questions there.
Chair, I have members of the committee to answer your question. The second question is, you're correct. Once they have been, once the new employee that has been hired on by the staffing agency, they no longer meet the definition of a unemployed worker. And so there's a period of time.
What you're saying is, for qualification for the Boost program, the loan applicant, the business, can't lease employees.
Correct.
Okay. And is that in statute somewhere?
No, it's
rules probably.
Chair, member of the committee, it comes down to how we're able to validate this information and the processes that we can implement. The Boost program was funded with about $1 million in this grant program, and so part of the processes that were developed and implemented are through an automated relationship with the employment department to gather and validate the data. By adding multiple layers, we ultimately increase the cost of administering the Boost grant program, and it makes it less efficient for us to administer.
But that doesn't make sense, because your relationship with your sister agency, all you need is a Social Security number, and you can determine how long they've been unemployed. I mean, that verification process shouldn't be that big of an issue.
But it comes down to a technicality as to whether or not they're employed at the time.
Well, it gets to your question of,
at least
can
employees.
The person be under the guidelines, can the person
be a leased employer?
Be a leased employee.
Sorry.
And that's really your question there.
And members of the committee, for the record, Paul Grove with Business Oregon, and as Senator Telfer alluded to, this was John had some initial discussions with her office about addressing this issue, and this is something that arose in standing up the program and implementing it. So I think it's something that will require further attention on our part and working with the senator and others to, you know, iron out the kinks, so to speak, with respect to this. So we'll look forward to working with the senator on the amendments.
What? Good try. I think the issue really gets back to the policy choice, and I raise a question because I wasn't here, and the rest of the members of this committee were. When you passed the Boost program, had you intended, is there a definition that the person be an employee? Does at least employee count as the...
I personally don't remember the discussion, Mr. Chair, about that. Maybe the proponents that drafted the bill did discuss it. There was definitely a discussion about the traded sector requirement. Seems like that could be addressed in rule, or if we don't. But that was definitely a part of the discussion, I know.
We've got a... The gist that the discussion's missing is we're trying to put people to work. So can I ask for a head nod up to this question? So if somebody joins the leasing company and the employment department is saying, well, now they're an employee, are they working?
Come on.
No, but that's actually it. Are they working? You're paying them as soon as they join.
Okay. If they're doing work for the...
Well, no, but the answer is no.
I'm just signing up.
Just because they sign up doesn't mean they're working.
No, right.
Okay, so here's the policy issue isn't whether or not the definition of them being an employee or not. It's whether or not they have work or not. That's the first issue. The second issue is, should the state of Oregon compete with private enterprise who's trying to place them when the overall goal of private enterprise and the state is to get people employed? Those are the two issues. And as far as, sorry, but working with Senator Telfer, this is a low bill number. This baby's been out there a while. I think you guys are a little late to the party. Personal question, but that, to me, that's the policy concern here. I mean, if you're saying they're an employee and they're not actually working, maybe I mean, somebody gets desperate, you know, they've been unemployed for 60 days, their unemployment's running out, they haven't been able to go to the employment department and find anything, so they go to a private business, say, hey, I'll try this now. And all of a sudden they hit a different classification. It doesn't mean they're working. It means they're pulling at strings if I were the employee, if I was the guy in that position. Forgive me if I'm wrong. To me, that sounds like the policy issue.
Senator Beyer, Senator Atkinson, members of the committee, and I can't answer the specific question that the proponents of the bill nodded to in the back in terms of what the employment department categorizes as an employee or not. I know that with respect to the boost grant portion of the program, again, the employee or the prospective new hire had to have been unemployed for 60 days, and I apologize, but I can't speak to what the determination is at the employment department level as far as signing up for that with that private entity if for some reason and I can certainly get back with you on that, if that individual then therefore is disqualified. But very, I recognize the question and the issue that you're raising, and certainly would follow up on that.
Is anybody
here from the appointment?
Senator Edwards.
Sorry. We're wondering down here, is anybody from the employment department going to come testify? I know.
Poor guy.
But
it's their program. Senator Starr, did you have an issue?
You haven't gotten word.
No, it's just we're asking questions to the Business Development Department that the Employment Department needs to answer.
That's true, but I think the requirements, I don't know whose administrative rules these are. I suspect they're yours.
Yes,
hiring guidelines. So they're not really the employment department's, they're theirs. The core of the question is not the competition on referring employees. I mean, the state and federal government have been in that business for years. That's really not the issue. The issue really becomes one of determining if someone is qualified, which I think the referral, from my experience in this area, this gentleman and other agencies could refer people, and the business could have them determined qualified through a simple process at the employment department. That's not the issue. The real issue is, in terms of employment and fulfilling the concept under the bill, is a business who uses at least employees, does that constitute employment? That's really the question. And I don't know the answer to that, and I'm looking at what's here in terms of the bill form, it doesn't really get to that. I think it's in the administrative rules.
I think the issue, Mr. Chair, is when does employment begin? Because the state is going to say as soon as they sign with an employment company, they're employed. But as if I were the worker who signs with the employment agency or the private company, that doesn't mean I'm getting a paycheck.
I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, and under the model, if I'm hearing it right, the issue is they are never employed by the company if they're employed by a leasing agency. That's the way it's been interpreted. So they would never qualify until they moved off of the leasing agency's payroll onto the company's payroll. That's the issue. Who's an employee? That's the question. I think, gentlemen, you need to go back and research this a little bit. Maybe we need to take a look at it and check into what the requirements were. I don't think we're there today. Perhaps you can be prepared to at least address that. It could be, frankly, the legislature's fault in the way we wrote the bill in the past. No.
But there's one other issue.
One other thing. Is there anything else you think?
Yeah, there is. Because, you know, for years, and a decade ago, it's kind of gone away now, but the employment department used to do everything they could to not allow Jobs Plus to take place. It was a huge debate around here. Should you have Jobs Plus? Should you not have Jobs Plus? And the employment department always fought Jobs Plus because for a variety of political issues. In the testimony from our friend Prineville, it appeared to me that government was competing with private enterprise. Did I miss that too?
I'm not.
Yeah?
I mean, I thought that.
I hear you saying that. I don't quite see that, but I get it. Yeah.
It's right here.
Okay.
And to me, that if that's the case, if that's my, that to me, that sounds like the same thing. We all the heartache of Jobs Plus that we. To me, that feels like Jobs Plus Part Two. I don't know if that's accurate, but I'll just put that for you as this bill comes forward. That to me, those are the issues I'm looking at.
Okay. More questions. I think we have to do some work on this bill.
That's what I was imagining with the legislature.
Anything else? Okay, I am going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 785. That's it, right? Is there anything else for the good of the committee?
I have a question.
Oh, you have a question.
Do you do P90X?
I have no idea.
This guy's built.
We do.
Look how hard he hits that thing. Go ahead, hit it. There you go.